Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The comments on this series have increasingly turned to the use of biologics in non-small cell cancer, and I met with Dr. Roy Herbst, who had just presented at the Chemotherapy Foundation Symposium in New York, for his take on this rapidly evolving area. Dr. Herbst began our conversation by putting in perspective what this evolving paradigm means to patient outcomes.
We're in a very fertile time of new drug development, and the session discussed at least 6 to 10 new drugs for lung cancer, many small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors, of course some antibodies such as bevacizumab and cetuximab. But the bottom line is, while there are clearly benefits to patients with this disease, the benefits are all small. You know, we're talking hazard ratios for survival in the 0.8 or higher range. So the trick is now going to be to try to find how to use these agents best in which patients to match the drug to the right tumor. And the one complexity of lung cancer is the heterogeneity of the disease. There are so many different reasons why patients develop lung cancer, from genetic causes, of course, to smoking, though we now know that the never smoker with lung cancer is emerging as a very unique group of patients who could have EGFR gene mutations. They often lack RAS gene mutations. It really behooves us to start to think about lung cancer in a more specific way. So what I discussed here at the meeting was the approach we're taking at MD Anderson, which is building upon the new drug development, trying to do biopsy-driven trials where everyone who comes in, you know, who consents, gets a biopsy in the second or more line setting. And this is a fresh biopsy, and the one thing that I brought to bear on the audience today was the fact that it can be done. If you have a research infrastructure and you have good interventional radiologists who work closely with the oncologists and the research nurses, you can biopsy patients in real time, meaning someone can come into the clinic and within a couple of days you get a biopsy and within a few weeks you get a result, and then you can try to use that result to pick therapy. Now, the challenge of this is, early on, it's hard to link the right marker with the right treatment because we don't know much yet. We have some ideas, for example, with EGFR and with RAS. But as we go along, we'll learn more. And the way we've designed these trials at MD Anderson is using adaptive trial design, meaning the first group of patients is randomized to active agents, but not in any particular way. But then as we learn more, we create an algorithm that allows patients to go onto the arm based on the biomarkers that they've obtained.
Now, is this kind of tied into your battle plan study?
Right. We call it battle at MD Anderson affectionately because it is funded through a grant from the Department of Defense and also through our Cancer Center Corps. The fact that we have the infrastructure to obtain tissue biopsies and to use them in real time. But I would contest that that's the future in all tumors, and lung cancer is a poster child for that because of the heterogeneity, because of the need to try to identify patients who would either respond, or perhaps you can find people that definitely won't respond so that you don't use that agent. And it will also help us to develop combinations of therapies, because it's quite obvious that if a drug like erlotinib, you know, which clearly has a great effect in some patients and a moderate effect in others, but if we could figure out how to combine that with something else, if we knew what other pathways were activated in those patients' tumors, we could do even better. And I was sitting there at the symposium this morning just thinking we have great progress in the last few years, but now it's really time to try to match the right patient to the right drug, and then we can take it even a step further, think about using these drugs in earlier stage disease or even, you know, chemo prevention.
Before we get into some of the translational science in terms of the pragmatics, what are some of the sites of metastatic disease that you've been biopsying, and what kinds of problems or challenges have you encountered?
Well, we've biopsied over 200 patients now with recurrent lung cancer, and more than half the biopsies have been in the lung. And we're able to do core biopsies in the lung. We usually try to obtain 3 passes of tissue. And the main problem, of course, in the lung is going to be the risk of pneumothorax. And you will see that 20%+ of the time. But the good news is only 1% of the time, or even less, have these patients needed to be hospitalized because of this. Sometimes we'll send patients home with a small little chest tube, a little pigtail catheter. But for the most part, we're able to do this with quite good results. We've obtained tissue this way about 83% of the time that's usable for the biopsies.
What about bone, liver, you know, other sites?
We'll biopsy lymph nodes if we see lymph nodes either in different parts of the body, supraclavicular lymph node, for example. I've been impressed with the liver. You know, again, we're being very selective who we biopsy. And the key thing, I guess, is you biopsy only after discussion of the films with a radiologist. And, you know, our guys will tell us what they're comfortable with or not. And that's where experience gets in. And we'll share our experience, hopefully, at ASCO this year formally. But the idea is that you actually can biopsy the liver. You can biopsy adrenal glands. And the bone is not a very good site. If there's a large medullary component of tumor in the bone, you can get some good tissue. But if it's just going into bone, I would not advise that. After you decorticate bone, the amount of tumor cells left that might be usable for these tests, and we're doing 11 different tests for our program that includes some DNA sequencing and some immunochemistry. So you need about 15 unstained slides in order to do this.
You know, it's interesting. We just had a day-long roundtable meeting entitled Tissue Biomarkers in the Management of Breast Cancer. And I think that maybe we could probably do the same thing with lung cancer.
Right. It's time. In fact, it's already happening because look at some of the major cancer centers now with the science that they have there. And, you know, it's probably not that much more expensive to do 80 DNA sequencing tests as it is to do one or two. The two you would think of are KRAS and EGFR. So I can tell you that I know that many places are either doing these tests up front, and then, of course, there are questions regarding what sort of consent do you get to do that and what do you do with the information. Or I would at least suggest that DNA be saved so that at some point it could be looked at in the future as a research tool. But, you know, if you look at some of the drugs that we have, we're studying PDGF inhibitors in lung cancer. We know that there's a new, very rare, but a fusion between EMLA and ALK gene fusion that occurs in lung cancer. These are very rare events, but now there are some drugs that are active if patients have these particular mutations. We could start to think that we should start to test for some of these more rare mutations that occur in lung cancer, and probably centers will need to collaborate so that there's a network of trials available for these patients. Because even though it's a small percentage of patients, these are patients we can truly benefit. You know, if someone has an EGFR mutation right now, their chance of responding to an EGFR inhibitor is upwards of 80%. Now, within a year, they're very likely, if they're on erlotinib, to become resistant. But then there are many clinical trials with second and third generation EGFR inhibitors, so-called irreversible inhibitors, the inhibitors that work against the mutation known as T790M, which is a common resistance mutation to EGFR. These are rare events, but if you are testing in enough centers, you'll find these patients and you can help them. And even if you're only helping 5% of an original 15% of lung cancer patients, it still gets up there into a large number of patients, you know, on the order of some of the number of cases that we're dealing with in the heme malignancies, for example.
One of the issues that came up in our breast cancer discussion is changing of markers with time. You know, for example, ER-positive tumor becoming ER-negative, HER2, whatever. Do we know anything about that in lung cancer?
We don't, but the type of work we're doing in our center is going to help. Because very often, you know, the biopsy that's obtained when you ask for a block is not recent, but it could be from 6 months, a year or more ago. It's the initial biopsy of diagnosis in a disease like lung cancer. But then if you're biopsying the metastatic site, that's different. Those are selected cells that were the ones that metastasized. We are going to need to start to look at primary tumors versus metastatic sites and get a sense for whether there are any differences and whether that biology can help us. Certainly there's heterogeneity, you know, where you biopsy could have a difference as well. And certainly the whole idea of a seed and soil hypothesis and the effect of tumor environment. So the complexity of this is enormous. Some have suggested one way to get around that might be to look at circulating tumor cells, you know, where you can get cells from multiple areas. But then again, those cells are going to be enhanced based on certain factors that we can't control either.
One thing that's kind of interesting that I don't quite understand is why doesn't more tissue marker studies, at least EGFR mutations, get done with tumors that are resected? I mean, you have the tissue. I mean, you think like even at least in non-smokers, I mean, it doesn't seem, as opposed again to say breast and even colon cancer now, that a specimen gets removed and it routinely gets some kind of tissue testing. Any thoughts about that?
Right. Well, this is something that groups are beginning to get together to sort of issue recommendations on this. This is still in the infancy, but I'll speak my mind in that I do think that you should have these tests on all patients. You know, it's just like you have HER2 for patients with breast cancer. And we're actually looking at MD Anderson at putting into place a policy where we will get these routinely on our patients, the ones that are operated and biopsied at MD Anderson. And then, of course, the question is going to be, what do we do with people that come from the outside? And very often when people come from the outside, we ask them for tissue, but we don't ask them for the tissue blocks. So we're actually beginning to explore the possibility of asking people to either bring their tissue block, or if they can't get their tissue block, to bring unstained slides. But I agree with you. There's enough information now emerging about how patients will do with an EGFR mutation with an EGFR inhibitor such as erlotinib that I think you would want to have that information on someone when you're treating in the upfront setting. And there's enough information beginning to emerge about RAS as a negative predictive factor for EGFR inhibitor activity that you probably want to have that information.
So if a doc in practice were to say to you, you know, we have our hospital here and our chest surgeon, et cetera. What are the tests that you think should be done on every patient who has their tumor removed? Or do you think there should be some selectivity based on their smoking status or whatever?
Well, I think that the problem is these tests are not routinely available at all centers. Now, many people send them away to reference labs, and you would think that that reference lab could do it. The best time to do it is when you have the big tissue block. I certainly think that anyone who's had a smoking history that's light or who's never smoked, I think they must get an EGFR mutation test. I think I would definitely do that. I also think you can make a case for looking at FISH, meaning gene amplification, using a fluorescence in situ hybridization technique, because that's been shown to correlate with activity of EGFR inhibitors as well. If those are negative, or certainly if the EGFR mutation is negative, then I would definitely want to look at a RAS mutation as well, because we know that patients with RAS mutation are much less likely to respond to EGFR inhibitors. But if someone's a never smoker, based on the recent IPASS data that were presented in Stockholm, which looked at patients who were light smokers and Asian, so a group very highly enhanced by EGFR mutation, certainly in the group that had EGFR mutations, and this was treatment with gefitinib, Arecanol. It's a study started a number of years ago, and of course they're still using gefitinib quite a bit in Asia. Gefitinib versus chemotherapy, the time to progression was more than double in the group that received the EGFR inhibitor versus chemo.
With the whole study or the mutation patients?
With the mutation patients. It was for the whole study, no, but for the mutation patients, suggesting that that's a selected group that could do much better. Now, will this study end up showing an overall survival benefit? That remains to be seen. One issue, of course, is that patients will cross over in the study and the chemo group will end up getting the EGFR inhibitor. But it's my feeling, if someone has an EGFR mutation, is a light smoker, to give them chemotherapy up front, I'd rather not do that. I want to try to enhance that group's chance of living longer with, or at least with a better quality of life, because certainly the toxicities of treatment with an EGFR inhibitor are much less than standard chemotherapy.
What about EGFR TKIs in the adjuvant setting for mutation-positive patients?
Well, you know, that's always a tricky question. It comes up all the time right now. There is, of course, a trial called RADIANT, which is testing that. So the proper answer to that, you know, is you should do this on a clinical trial. But as you and I both know, that if it's, you're looking the patient in the eye and you don't have the trial open at your center, or many people don't want to be randomized, what do you do? There are a couple of centers around the country that have developed trials just for that indication. There are data just out today that Tarceva as maintenance therapy improved time to progression in patients with advanced metastatic disease. We certainly know that these agents are active, and that was an unselected group of patients. So in the adjuvant setting, in someone with a mutation, you know that they have definitely, you know, increased responsiveness. The question is, there are no data. You can look at the SWOG-023 trial, which used gefitinib as adjuvant therapy after chemo radiation, and you could even warn someone that in that case it was harmful. No one could explain why. It was a different setting. It was an unselected setting. It was patients who had received pretty harsh chemo radiation up front. Then you could say, okay, well, we could give you the erlotinib, but for how long? Do you do it for a year? Do you do it for 2 years? So what I started doing now is having a discussion with a patient. I try to encourage them to go to a site where there is a clinical trial. If they're unwilling to do that, I prefer not to do it off protocol. But, you know, if I discuss it with someone and they understand the pros and cons, I don't think it's a wrong thing to do. But certainly that's an area that we really need to have the information on, because we know that even in someone with a stage 2 lung cancer, the chance of recurrence at 5 years could be as high as 30-40%. And if they truly do have a few tumor cells and they're EGFR mutated and they're going to die if they're treated with a period of time with an EGFR inhibitor, that might be the best time to cure them. But we just don't know yet.
You know, it's interesting in terms of how people approach metastatic incurable disease in a solid tumor. You think about breast cancer, people generally are continuously treated. They wait till they progress and they switch to something else. Colon cancer, you see the idea of the holiday. You know, give chemo for a while and stop and then restart it. In lung cancer, from my take, it's been give it, stop, and wait. And now this concept of maintenance. Any thoughts about these different strategies and which ones make the most sense?
Well, we know we're not curing anyone in the metastatic setting. So, you know, watch and wait is just for the lack of anything better. So I, for one, do think maintenance hopefully will make sense. The question is, maintenance at what cost? You know, you would want to have an agent that's reasonably well tolerated with few side effects. Certainly the best maintenance agent would be oral, so the patient can get themselves away from the medical establishment for a bit. And then I think the more effective maintenance agents will be ones specifically designed for any given tumor. Look at the bevacizumab ECOG 4599 trial. That trial included maintenance. And I personally think that once you get the tumor down to a minimal level of bulk, you perhaps are maintaining tumor cells in a dormant or inactive state. Are we going to cure anyone with maintenance? I don't know. Patients often ask me about that. They say, why would anyone want to take a drug for long periods of time? Then I just refer them to other diseases in medicine, like diabetes and other chronic diseases, heart disease, hypertension, where people take drugs and it doesn't cure the problem, but it manages it. So I do think that there is going to be something to this. I think that early evidence that a drug like pemetrexed or erlotinib might have an effect there is encouraging, but I think to truly be active, we're going to have to find the right maintenance drug for any given patient.
Let's talk a little bit about cetuximab. We did a symposium. You were in that symposium at ASCO on lung cancer, and of course the FLEX data had just been reported on cetuximab. You studied cetuximab. Can you kind of put together where we are today in terms of this issue and also the issue of predictors of response?
Well, you know, cetuximab is certainly an active agent in a number of tumor types, colon cancer, head and neck cancer, and now lung cancer. Though the FLEX trial, while positive, had a hazard ratio of only 0.87. So, you know, that's a benefit, but it's a pretty small benefit. And I think you need to look at it that way. Since ASCO, what's happened, people are using it. I have a sense that it's not being used a great deal, but it's being used enough, certainly in patients with squamous cell tumors who can't get bevacizumab. And I'm using it in my practice in that setting. But clearly we're going to need to try to find a biomarker, as was done with the CRYSTAL study in colorectal cancer, to find more activity. Because like other EGFR inhibitors, cetuximab does produce skin rash. Coming in for weekly treatments is quite burdensome. So I do think it would be important to try to figure out exactly who might benefit most from this drug. How are we going to do that? We're going to need to do studies where we obtain tissue and we look at biomarkers. We actually have a large effort on this in the SWOG. A paper that Fred Hirsch was the lead author on, published this last July in JCO, actually looked at a SWOG study where we looked at cetuximab with chemotherapy concurrently versus chemotherapy followed by cetuximab in a parallel arm study. And actually, we saw that both arms of this study, about 100 patients in each arm, metastatic lung cancer, had a median survival of 11 months, whether they got cetuximab with chemotherapy or cetuximab after chemotherapy. That tells us that cetuximab might be having an effect both with chemotherapy but also after chemotherapy. But the one important finding that was published in that paper was that we looked at EGFR gene amplification by FISH. And this is the test that Fred Hirsch has developed, where we look at four or more copies of the EGFR gene in more than 40% of the cells. And we actually found that the median survival was double in the concurrent group, in those patients who had gotten the FISH test done and were shown to be positive versus those that were not. So it suggests that EGFR FISH could be a very useful predictor for patients who are going to do better with cetuximab. We were so excited by these data that we immediately developed a phase 3 concept in SWOG, which has now gained CTEP approval and is being rapidly developed and will soon be initiated in the Southwest Oncology Group, which is going to take patients and treat them with chemotherapy and cetuximab in a way that the trial is powered to answer the question if EGFR FISH, if EFR increased gene copy number, is in fact a predictive marker for outcome. So that trial is going to SWOG 0819, and that trial is in the books, and we should see it around the country within the next 6 months.
Which chemo is going to be used in the new study?
In the new study, we're actually going to use carboplatin. So we feel that we can do that. That gets to a big issue. The FLEX trial was done with cisplatin vinorelbine. Very few people are comfortable using that regimen, though certainly it's used a great deal more in Canada and in Europe. We feel that the data from this 099 trial that was led by Tom Lynch and run through Bristol-Myers showed that there was some activity, clearly, of carboplatin paclitaxel with the cetuximab. And it's our feeling that that's a reasonably good regimen that people are comfortable using. So we're going to try to build on that and increase the efficacy by using the FISH prediction.
You know, there was the issue of the IHC, and of course that was looked at in the FLEX study, but kind of thinking back to colon cancer, where sort of IHC sort of tanked out initially, was part of the FDA indication, et cetera. Has FISH been looked at in colon cancer for the cetuximab?
Not yet, though. I know that it is being talked about and some analyses are ongoing, but I don't know of anything that's been published. In colon cancer, they focus more on the RAS, of course.
Right, right. But, you know, you wonder whether or not it would actually make any sense to look at EGFR for FISH.
Right. So in the group of patients that are RAS wild type, then perhaps you can enhance that group better by looking at FISH. It's certainly a reasonable hypothesis.
Where are you today? You know, again, we chatted at ASCO, having a little few more months to sort of think about it. in terms of thinking about management of patients who are, quote, BEV eligible. So adenocarcinoma could have been in the ECOG study, BEV versus cetuximab.
Right. And actually, the whole issue of BEV eligibility is changing a little bit.
Right.
It's not officially in the label yet, but I think most people are comfortable on clinical trial now including treated brain metastases in patients with bevacizumab. And actually, we're doing that on most of our trials right now.
Could I just ask what you consider clinically, you know, quote, treated brain mets to the point that you'd be comfortable with BEV? And what do we know from the data that's been presented? I think there was some stuff at ASCO on that.
Well, it would be radiation to the brain. In most cases, that's going to be whole brain. But I would also accept a radiosurgery treatment if it's just one or two small nodules. And then at least 3 weeks afterwards and stability off of steroids. So someone who's clinically stable and isn't requiring steroids to manage that. And I think that's a reasonable window. You don't want to wait too much longer because we're dealing with a disease with quite a fast pace. So in trials that we're designing at MD Anderson in our future trials in the SWOG, we are allowing patients with treated brain metastases to go on bevacizumab. We're also much more comfortable with anticoagulation than we were at one time. And that's good because with the CAT scans, as sensitive as they are these days, you know, you find a pulmonary embolus asymptomatically 20 to 30% of the time these days. It's the most common admission to our hospital on a lung service. So now we are allowing anticoagulation. You know, preferably you like to use low molecular weight heparin just so you can stop it easier. But the reality of life is that you can't do that in all patients. It's not covered in many cases. So we will allow it with Coumadin. But if I do treat someone with Coumadin, my feeling is you should be pretty tight in your management. And not everyone will treat someone with Coumadin, and trials will sometimes exclude Coumadin, just for the record. Then there's a whole issue of the squamous versus the adeno, or the non-squamous and the squamous. From what I can see from the data emerging, there isn't very much that's going to change that right now. There are no robust studies that show that you can treat squamous patients. There will be some data presented next week at the meeting in Chicago, the ASTRO-ISLAC-ASCO meeting, the beta trial. And this trial actually was opened up to non-central squamous tumors, meaning that if the tumor was squamous and in the lung, it had to be within a centimeter of the pleura, and it also allowed for extrathoracic squamous disease. And that will be some experience treating squamous with bevacizumab, though I can tell you that the number of patients is going to be just a small fraction of that trial that had squamous, so I don't think that would add to the pool of data dramatically. So that's one area.
What did they see?
Well, I think those patients who had squamous tumors tolerated the drug reasonably well. But again, it's a very selected group, and you know, in a trial of 600-plus patients, we're talking probably less than 50 patients, and the exact numbers will be presented at the meeting. So I think that right now, that's the biggest group that's not going to be eligible for bevacizumab. I can tell you it makes it hard as we design trials because we can't use that agent, and that's not going to change, in my opinion, very soon.
What about location?
You know, we were involved, gosh, it's more than 10 years ago now, in the early phase two trials of bevacizumab and chemotherapy, and I remember the conference calls as patients were beginning to bleed. And we had four fatal deaths on that trial in 60-plus patients. And it turned out, when we looked at the subgroups, that it tended to be squamous patients that bled. And it was always my feeling, and I think most would agree, that squamous histology was just another way of looking at location, because most of those squamous tumors tended to be centrally located. I actually am comfortable treating someone with a central tumor with bevacizumab. I've done it. I think you need to watch closely. It is a matter of where that tumor is. If that tumor responds very quickly and one of the walls of that tumor is abutting a major vessel, that can be a problem. I certainly wouldn't treat anyone who has any bleeding to begin with, but I wouldn't deny someone with an adenocarcinoma with a central tumor the chance to get bevacizumab. I'd just be very, very cautious and watch it very carefully.
Do you think there is, in fact, assuming that it's not wrapped around a vessel, do you think that there is an increased risk of bleeding with central lesions?
Well, you know, that's never really panned out, but the problem is the numbers are so small. So the good news is the numbers are so small. The bad news is the numbers are so small that there aren't enough to really do a robust study. There is a safety database that's emerging in lung cancer that keeps getting updated each year. And I think with time, we might get some inkling whether central location is, in fact, a risk factor for bleeding.
So based on what we know right now, how do you think the risk-benefit ratio compares, let's say, in a BEV-eligible patient, adenocarcinoma, for example, in terms of chemo-BEV versus chemo-cetuximab?
Well, you know, they're very different risks. From the standpoint of tolerability, there's no question the bevacizumab is much better tolerated in the majority of patients, but for the 2% that are going to bleed and have a fatal bleed, that's the ultimate toxicity. So it's pick which risk you want to take. You can have the small chance of a fatality. I think it's probably, if you select, if you're sure you don't take anyone who's bleeding and you're careful, you can probably bring that down even a little bit lower than 2%. But still, you've got to tell someone there's about 2% chance that you'll bleed. And once that happens, there's nothing we're going to be able to do about it. There really isn't much therapy. Versus someone who can be on bevacizumab for 3 or 4 years and they're hiking and they're traveling and they feel great. Versus if you use cetuximab where you're guaranteed to have a rash, where you're going to have some fatigue, where you're going to have weekly visits. So I think it's much more difficult to give cetuximab. There is the risk of an anaphylactic reaction, but that's unless you live in a certain part of the southeast where there's a belt, you know, where patients are much more sensitive to the drug, where the risk of that severe reaction can be between 10 and 15%, it's really less than 1%. And as long as you're getting it in a major center that can deal with an anaphylactic reaction, and almost anyone who gives chemotherapy is able to do that. We see that with the cream of four drugs as well. I think it's safer. It doesn't have that grade 5, that death associated with it, but it does have other complications.
I guess that's starting to get worked out in terms of identifying an antibody and even an assay or a serum assay that will predict who these patients are.
Right. There's some very nice science done by the group at Vanderbilt to figure that out. There isn't a formulation that can be used in those patients, but at least you know who not to try it on.
What about the issue of Bev plus an EGFR antibody cetuximab? I've heard that there's a new trial that's going to actually look at that in lung cancer.
Right. So the whole area of EGFR and VEGF dual inhibition in lung cancer is a very interesting one. And certainly we've seen some early data with bevacizumab and erlotinib, that those two drugs together, first in phase 1 and then in randomized phase 2, appeared to be better than chemotherapy. There was just a trial, and we have the top-line data known as BETA, that took bevacizumab, erlotinib, and compared it to erlotinib with a placebo. The release on that has shown that the trial missed its overall survival endpoint, though it did show a significant improvement in progression-free survival and response rate. Those data will be presented at the meeting next week in Chicago, the ISLAC-ASCO meeting. What about bevacizumab and cetuximab? That's an interesting question because the experience in colorectal cancer has been less than positive. In fact, there was a trial, I believe it was called Cairo.
Yeah, Cairo 2, and then there was the PACE trial before it.
Right, and those trials, PACE being with panitumumab, but still showed that there was increased toxicity in combination with chemotherapy. That said, SWOG did a pilot study led by Ed Kim, SWOG-0536, and this was a trial that gave the four drugs, carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and cetuximab. And I can tell you the median survival of that combination was upwards of 13 months, close to 14 months. And those data are still maturing, but it clearly looked like that was an active combination. Actually, the endpoint of the trial was not activity, it was toxicity. Could the four drugs be given? And the answer was yes. So much so that we've added that as an arm to our SWOG trial that I told you about earlier, the SWOG-0819. So SWOG-0819, well, the key question is asking whether EGFR gene amplification by FISH is a predictive marker, is allowing those patients who are BEV eligible to get BEV. So that means that there will be an arm of the quadruplet, carboplatin, bevacizumab, and cetuximab in that trial based on Ed's phase 1 work. So you might say, should you be careful about this because of the data in colorectal cancer? Sure. But at least in the pilot trial of 100 patients in lung cancer, we didn't see any problem. So it deserves to be studied. Certainly it's going to have to be watched very carefully as the trial goes forward. But at least so far, it doesn't look like there's a problem with toxicity. And even the early data suggests that there might even be increased efficacy.
You mentioned the combination of Bev and erlotinib that you've been so involved in looking at. Can you talk more about what we know about that right now and where you think it's heading?
Well, certainly the idea of using a non-chemotherapy doublet is very attractive to avoid cytotoxicity and myelosuppression and neuropathy and so forth. And the bevacizumab-erlotinib combination certainly is one that is easy to give, had minimal toxicity, really not much more than you would get for erlotinib alone, and has actually shown some good activity in phase 2. So that went to phase 3. Actually, the phase 2 was a combination of erlotinib, bevacizumab, and that was compared to chemotherapy. The phase 3 was a little bit of a different design. It took erlotinib, bevacizumab, and compared that to erlotinib with a placebo. And that was a large trial, 650 trial, known as BETA. And unfortunately, BETA did not hit its primary endpoint. There was no improvement in overall survival for erlotinib, bevacizumab versus erlotinib alone. Now, you can ask why that is. If you look at the secondary endpoints, progression-free survival and response, it did meet the endpoint there. So there clearly was activity of the regimen. However, it just wasn't enough activity to show an improvement in survival. But But one has to actually ask these days, are we going to be able to show survival in any trials in lung cancer when you have a second-line trial where 30 or 40% of the patients went on to receive subsequent therapy? And many of those subsequent agents are probably active. And those data are being fully analyzed, and they'll be presented sometime within the year. But the idea is that perhaps we're not going to be able to use survival as our endpoint anymore with these targeted agents, because many people could go on and receive bevacizumab on the control arm of that trial, or they could get other new studies with active small molecules. So the good news is that combination clearly has some activity. It's still being studied in other trials. There's a very important trial known as ATLAS, especially in light of the recent release of the news release from Roche that Saturn, which was a maintenance trial with erlotinib, showed some benefit as a maintenance after chemotherapy. What ATLAS is looking at is it's looking at erlotinib bevacizumab versus bevacizumab. So it's looking to one-up that with the erlotinib bevacizumab doublet. So we'll eagerly await that result now. But at least in an unselected patient, I think one probably shouldn't use erlotinib bevacizumab off protocol based on these data. They might have some activity in selected populations, perhaps, and that's going to be looked at.
What about predictors of response to bevacizumab? It's been kind of discouraging. There was kind of some interesting stuff that's come out recently in breast, and I think renal maybe about the possibility of hypertension or SNPs or whatever. I mean, what are your thoughts about the overall issue of prediction of response to Bev and specifically in lung cancer?
Incredibly, we have very little to go on right now. It's hard because the primary target is the endothelial cell, not the tumor cell. So it makes it a little bit more difficult. Could you find a population of endothelial cells and know that it's more sensitive? The whole idea of angiogenesis is that this is a very redundant process, and there's more than just VEGF. There are many pro-angiogenic factors. So I think we're going to have to try to learn a little bit more about given tumors, what angiogenic profile is driving that tumor, and have a better understanding through a large number of patients with good follow-up, who benefits and who doesn't from bevacizumab. But that's actually, as we move forward at MD Anderson with our biomarker-based program, which we call BATTLE, we're actually very interested now to approach bevacizumab and try to develop markers for its activity. Because if you look right now, yeah, sure, you can say people develop hypertension, but that's sort of a marker. It's a reaction to the drug. What you want is something a priori. You're looking at the patient's tumor. What is it about that patient's tumor that's going to tell you if they're going to benefit or not? And we don't really have that now.
Let's talk a little bit about new agents. And I want to ask you, you were part of the team that published a paper in the JCO recently looking at the TKI vandetanib alone or with paclitaxel carbo. Can you talk a little bit about that agent?
Right. So TKIs, there are just so many of those being studied with varying specificities. Vandetanib is would fall into the category multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And it has activity against a significant number of tyrosine kinases, but the three that come to mind and that are the most prominent would be very low IC50, meaning quite potent against vascular endothelial growth factor receptor, about tenfold less potent but still active against the epidermal growth factor receptor, and then in the middle, an activity against the RET oncogene, and that's why it's active in certain medullary thyroid cancers. But focusing on the two, the EGFR and the VEGFR, which are important in lung cancer, this agent clearly has single agent activity. Is it more active than erlotinib? That's the question of the day. There's a big phase 3 trial ongoing now, actually completed. We're awaiting data that went head-to-head, erlotinib versus vandetanib. And sometime within the next 6 months to the year, those data are expected. The data that you asked me about, our trial, we did a pilot trial. John Hamek was the first author, a study that looked at the drug with docetaxel in a randomized phase 2 design that compared it to docetaxel alone. Interestingly, we looked at two different doses of the oral agent vandetanib, either 100 milligrams or 300 milligrams with docetaxel versus docetaxel with a placebo. The endpoint of that trial was time to progression, and time to progression was improved from 12 to 18 weeks in the patients who got the 100 milligram dose, the lower dose of vandetanib. In the 300 milligram dose, time to progression was improved, but not significantly. What does this mean? Well, many of us believe that at 100 milligrams, the vandetanib is a very good VEGF inhibitor and probably doesn't have that much activity against the EGF receptor. And my personal theory is we know very well that EGF receptor inhibitors in unselected patients with chemotherapy don't do very much. In fact, many believe it could even be inhibitory to the activity of chemotherapy. So I'm thinking at 100 milligrams, vandetanib is working as a very good VEGF oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And it is one of the better ones. It's probably not the most potent by numbers out there, but it is well tolerated. The main toxicities are some skin rash and perhaps some mild diarrhea. So this is an
hypertension?
Hypertension, but not nearly at the levels that you see with some of the other small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors. But yes, you can see a mild bit of hypertension. The one thing that's dogged this drug from the very beginning is it produces some QTC prolongation, which, again, you know, we've tested and studied probably close to 100 patients at MD Anderson and never had a major problem because of that. But it requires a good deal of monitoring, and you have to look at the concomitant drugs you have someone on when you're following QTC.
How about hemoptysis?
There have been reported occasional cases of hemoptysis, but never to the point with this drug that there's been an exclusion of squamous cell patients from the trials. So it's been used in both adeno and squamous cell patients.
And is it your thought, where do you see things heading? And also in terms of the dose, where do you see things heading?
Well, you know, there's a phase 3 now, actually, which I lead, which is looking at the 100 milligram dose with docetaxel versus docetaxel and placebo. We call that the Zodiac trial. And as we tape now, those data are not known. But the trial is completed, and we're waiting for the final analysis. Now, if that trial is positive, I think we have, and, you know, of course, looking at the safety profile, we have a potential combination. That was a second-line trial. There's also a similar trial that's looking at pemetrexed as the background chemotherapy, the same design. Then there's a fourth trial with this drug, which is looking at people who have received erlotinib or gefitinib and then progressed, and then they're getting the drug vandetanib versus a placebo, to ask whether the dual activity can overcome resistance to an EGFR inhibitor alone. So there are four phase 3 trials. Three of them I know are completed. The fourth, I think, is a little bit further behind, which might yield data reasonably soon for a very interesting compound. Certainly, we know that it's tolerable. The question is it efficacious?
What about markers, some of the markers that we've talked about before, including EGFR mutations and this agent?
Well, this agent certainly, in a patient who has an EGFR mutation, is going to be more active. In fact, you would think that those might be a perfect population to test this drug in because it is a rather weak EGFR inhibitor. So, you know, it certainly would have activity there as well.
But, for example, the study that you were a part of, did you look at that?
We didn't, but we are collecting tissue in the phase 3. And we will look at EGFR mutations. Certainly, you'd want to look at RAS. Bob Kerbel and his colleagues showed more than a decade ago that when you have a mutation in RAS, that actually acts as a transcriptional factor for VEGF. So you actually have increased VEGF levels. So it makes a lot of sense that in someone who's RAS mutant, the very patient who's not going to be very responsive to erlotinib or gefitinib, they might benefit from dual inhibition with EGFR and VEGFR. So that's something that we might get out of this trial.
That's interesting. I'm not sure I remember seeing RAS and BEV in colon cancer.
Yeah, I don't know if that's been looked at or not, but it certainly should be.
Has it been looked at in lung cancer?
We're starting to do that in some of our biomarker-based trials to look at RAS in some of the patients who are getting the VEGF inhibitors.
What about poor old small cell? What's happening in terms of translational work there? Certainly, clinically, things aren't happening much.
No, well, we went down the path of CPT-11, and it's about 8 or 9 years now since the data reported out of Japan. And unfortunately, both those trials repeated in the United States did not show that platinum CPT-11 had any benefit. So that's gone away. Right now in small cell, there are a couple of interesting approaches. I think the angiogenesis inhibition is quite exciting. I can tell you from our personal work in SWOG, we're trying to develop a trial of cisplatinum etoposide with a drug AZD2171.
Cedirinib?
Yes, which is a small molecule inhibitor of VEGF receptor 1, 2, and 3. This is a trial that we're piloting now at a few sites. John Hamak is leading this, just to show that you can give this drug with chemotherapy. As you know, there have been some questions whether, as this drug has been used in colon cancer and then in lung cancer with chemotherapy, there has been the need for some dose reductions, because it does appear to increase the toxicity of chemotherapy. So that needs to be piloted quite carefully.
What specific toxicities?
Well, from what I've seen, patients tend to have a bit more diarrhea, more dehydration, which perhaps creates electrolyte abnormalities, fatigue, risk of cardiac events. But at 20 milligrams now in lung cancer in combination with chemotherapy, it looks like that's going to go forward, and we're excited to then test that in the SWOG. The other thing that's very interesting in small cell is the whole idea of BCL2. And, you know, BCL2 being a factor that's an anti-apoptotic pro-survival factor. And we know that the levels of BCL2 in small cell lung cancer, sort of akin to lymphoma, are quite high. And there are a couple of compounds. There's a Abbott Genentech compound that's being developed, which is a small molecule against BCL2. So that's being looked at as well. I haven't heard much on that trial recently, but I know that that's an interesting new target. But yes, small cell, you know, it's problematic to study small cell because those patients, when they are refractory or primary refractory, they progress so quickly, it's hard to do phase 1 and early stage trials. But clearly that's an area that it's a bit of a smaller population. You know, certainly as smoking rates go down, small cell is going to go down a little bit. I don't think I've ever seen a patient with small cell who hasn't had a big smoking history. But still, it's one where people need to start to do a little bit more focus, not for lack of effort. There's topotecan, but some combinations with topotecan are being looked at as well, too. I guess I just sort of say that lung cancer is still the most common cause of cancer death, and we are doing a bit better. I think the word to get out is that we have some improved treatments. Certainly for those patients who have EGFR mutations, I think we have a course of treatment that can be specific for them that needs to be applied. And then for the rest, we have, you know, some of the newer agents we've talked about today that are all benefiting with hazard ratios in the 0.8, 0.85, 0.87 range, which is good. But the key now is going to be to pluck off that 10% of patients with each drug who are really benefiting. And that's happening. That's the way drug development usually progresses. We have to show we have a safe and at least minimally effective regimen. And now the focus has to be on developing better mechanisms for obtaining tissue, for paying for those tests, and for doing them in a reproducible way. You know, the first responder is not always an MD Anderson or a Sloan Kettering or a Dana-Farber. It's going to be the local physician or clinic. So we're going to have to sort of develop guidelines for how this tissue is going to be obtained. And that's going to have to happen on a governmental level and with the societies making recommendations. But we're moving in that direction. And clearly the biology of lung cancer has progressed to the point where at least we can start to ask some of these questions. And then, of course, the key will be to move all these regimens earlier into the course of the disease.
So maybe next time you give this type of talk, what do you think about the title of Is Lung Cancer the New Breast Cancer?
I like that. Also, you know, we just wrote a paper in the New England Journal on molecular origins of lung cancer.
Right.
And that's a whole series on molecular origins of cancer, and there'll be articles on some of the other tumor types as well. Initially, we were going to make that article cover three or four different tumor types, but then it was enough just to do lung cancer, which wouldn't have been the case 3 or 4 years ago, which I think is a very positive thing.